Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Syria has been in the news lately. Trump's troop withdrawal, his betrayal of the Kurds, their slaughter by the Turks. But what about the Syrian opposition? The documentary For Sama, which airs on PBS Tuesday, November 19th, takes us inside Aleppo during the long, brutal siege by al-Assad and the Russians. Wad al-Khatib began shooting student graffiti on university walls, and a revolution rose around her, followed by an overwhelming response. Awarded Best Documentary at Cannes and winner of the Documentary Grand Jury Prize at South by Southwest Film Festival, I talk with directors Wad al-Khatib and Edward Watts, and with Dr. Hamza al-Khatib, who ran the last hospital in East Aleppo. Stick around and you'll get a unique feel for life and death inside Syria.
I'll be speaking today with filmmakers Wad al-Khatib and Edward Watts and Dr. Hamza al-Khatib, a key figure in their documentary film, For Sama. And let me just set things up here. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on Noah's Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Podomatic, Google Play, probably about 20 different podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. A quick plug for participation. Here's six organizations that I recommend that you look into if you're interested in resisting what's going on in D.C. and working toward the healthy and just society we all deserve. Indivisible.us is probably the most organized. They've got like 5,000 plus local organizations. You'll get an email from them every week saying what's up and what's worth doing. MoveOn.org, that's MoveOn, one word, .org, and Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org, are both digital activist organizations that are very closely working with grassroots organizations. MoveOn is National Courage Campaign, the state of California. Two specific ones, 5calls.org, the number 5 and the word calls, and that one tells you what are the most relevant and timely calls you might make to your local representatives. Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, tells you when your representatives are going to be holding meetings with their constituents back at home, and so you can go in and let them know how you feel. And finally, since climate change is such a huge threat, crisis, and so on, 350.org, I find the best activist organization working on climate change. Okay. I saw an extraordinary film recently, and I feel both lucky and humbled to have in the studio with me today three key figures who created the film and whose lives are the film. More than 500,000 people have died in Syria since the uprising against the regime of Bashar al-Assad began in 2011. The documentary For Sama, that's the word for, and Sama, S-A-M-A, which is the, in Syrian is sky, right?
Yeah.
And Sama is also the name of a child who's born in the course of the documentary. And this documentary takes us inside the heartbreaking suffering of the people of Aleppo during the long and brutal siege by al-Assad and then later joined by the Russians. College student Wad al-Khatib began shooting the uprising when it was young, folks spraying revolutionary graffiti on university walls. The revolution rises around her, as does the overwhelming response. And the film ends 5 years later when she accepts an offer of exile and is among the last to leave the destroyed city. Hamza al-Khatib is a physician and a revolutionary. He ends up running the last hospital to function in Aleppo as it falls. We see he and Wad go from friendship and comradeship to marriage and parenthood. Edward Watts is an Emmy Award-winning, BAFTA-nominated filmmaker who has directed over 20 films telling true stories in both narrative and documentary form. His 2015 film, Escape from ISIS, won numerous awards. And I want my guests to tell their stories, so I'm not going to say much more. Welcome, Wad al-Khatib, Edward Watts, and Hamza al-Khatib to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, July 24th.
Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. It's great to have all three of you. I love when, you know, there can be interaction among you as well as between you and me. And I make a point that I always want listeners to get a feel for the people besides the idea and the work that we talk about on this show. And so in this case, as I said, this work is about your lives as much as it is about making a film or staging an uprising. And so I'd like each of you to tell us your path to the film, not just how you got involved, but what brought you to it and what was your life like if there were no uprising, if there were no movie? What was that life? So listeners get a feel of what was sort of normalcy before the uprising began. Let me start with Wad.
I was just a student at Aleppo University. I had my own personal plan about finishing my studying and then go to Germany. I was doing a language course in Deutsch, and I was planning when I will finish to go and do master's in Germany. And I wasn't pretty sure about what next after the master, but everything was just about how I will leave Syria as soon as I can. We've never been like felt that we really belong to Syria, and the corruption, the whole system of the Syrian government before was just like push you a lot to just leave and don't care and don't think about anything. And if you wanna think, that will be like the first step of having a lot of troubles in your life. So it was more about, you know, I just wanna be out, be far, be not related. And then
let me ask you, was that shared among your friends, your family?
Everyone. I've before the revision, I've never like know Hamza, and when we met, he was in the first in the fifth level of language course to go also leave out of Syria. So maybe we will meet in Germany if that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But the thing
it was just the dream.
Yeah.
To leave Syria. Anywhere, a lot yeah. Like our generation was just focus on graduate from university. It's just like the physicians will go to France, Germany, US, and engineers will go to the Gulf and work there. This is like the and teachers also like the mathematics, physics, chemistry will just want to go to the Gulf and stay there.
And to speak more, like Hamza's family were in Saudi Arabia for
25 years.
My father was in Yemen. So it's like this is something very common with many, many other people. And we have that idea about who's working outside of Syria and coming back. He have like a higher level in just in the normal basic life. Just to stay.
The country full of corruption. It's either you have the relationship with the regime or you have the money.
Uh-huh.
So the people want just to go out, work, because it's the only way to have a decent life when they're coming back to Syria, and just to have like that extra amount of money to survive. We've never felt that we really belong to Syria, because the official name of Syria in all the media, all the banners, is Syria al-Assad, which is al-Assad's Syria. Like, this is what we were taught. This is how we rose up.
Now, by the way, you're not just saying Western media?
No.
The local media?
No, this is the local.
Yeah, the local
Assad media. Assad Syria. Local,
yeah, it's Assad's Syria.
In the whole course of your lifetime.
Yeah,
exactly.
Of course.
It's Assad's Syria. It was the father, Hafez, and when he killed, they changed the
constitution.
Exactly. In 5 minutes, to make it fitable for his son, because he was 32 or 34, and the rules was it's only 36. So in 5 minutes, like they make the amendments, change it, and now
to fit it to his son.
Just keep al-Assad's Syria.
So how many years in the two of them together? How many years?
Before I woke up in this country, and knowing that the only mighty leader is al-Assad, and the mighty like knights and the mighty like we call it like he is not we call it we were taught at the school that he is, and literally I'm saying the first, like they call it the first father, the first leader, and the first soldier, the first pilot.
Yeah, and he's Hafez al-Assad. And he's the leader forever. This is what, like...
This is what you're taught in school.
Exactly. As a, so yeah. we just want to go out, you know?
Of course.
Please.
So a couple of questions. And by the way, I like the way this is going. A couple of questions. How many people can afford to go to university and have that dream of leaving?
Yeah, the university is almost free in Syria. And like they started the private universities at maybe 2002, 2003. This is the first like private university. And how to go to university depends on how you, like the total marks that you get in all subjects to get to the university. And it was also part of the, I'm not say corrupted, but like the bad practice of all the systems in Syria. So in order for me to get to the medical school, I need to have like almost full marks mm-hmm. in all the subjects of study, which is even like literature, mm-hmm. Arabic language, which has no relationship with the
practice
with
medicine.
Practicing medicine. It's not focusing
it,
like about
especially science. If you're going to do it somewhere else. But.
Yeah, and also like in addition to this, if you are. And not if you are, because you are a member of al-Ba'ath Party, which is al-Assad Party, you have, if you were very, like, very good member of that al-Ba'ath Party, you can have additional marks with nothing, just because yeah. you are. So, for example, with my family, I have one of my cousins, which he needs just one mark to go to the medical college.
He's one mark short.
Yeah, and... He didn't get it because he's not a member of al-Ba'ath Party. While if you are, you got it, and most of the people are. Most of the people just being as this for a lot of things which you just got it because you are the good...
And how many people are members of the Ba'ath Party?
Everyone.
I was, but everyone. You don't need to think about it, you know? Like,
it's
I remember
not a choice, you know? It's not option.
When I was in the eighth grade, that was like after the primary school, elementary school, we just like a teacher came with like a special accent, which is like people from the coast, and he just gave us the papers and tell us like sign this to like join the party, and no one dare not to sign it.
Eighth
and,
grade.
Yeah.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. speaking about the marks, I like sorry cousin to say this, but I had a cousin who was he is now a dentist, and he was about 100 marks short, 100. And because he did some like course with the army, they gave him this 100 mark and he became a dentist. While like her cousin, he was just one mark short. And because he's not part of that corrupted system, he didn't get it.
So he was a member of Ba'ath Party because everyone is, but
actually,
he wasn't involved.
No, it's this is one of the things which my background as a family were against the regime since I was born. They don't have that very clear opinion or clear inform for everyone. But we have that about like most of my cousins who were in the schools and the university, we weren't. In addition to this, like Hamza's story about when the teacher came, and this is the same scene in my mind until now. She came into the class when we were 15. She gave us all these papers in front of us, and she just like stand and said, "Yeah, sign it and give it to me." So, like, I have a little bit of space in my family, which I knew a lot of stories. I have my mother's brother was in the presence of Assad for 4 years. So I have a little bit of the background about we hate the regime. I don't know a lot of details, but this is just what I was raising up through my years. But even this, it wasn't allowed to me to say that in public.
Sure, sure.
So what I remember, I've seen the picture. I read that I am there's space to write your name and then member of Al-Ba'ath. I would love to, you know, and with a lot of like...
respect.
Yeah, respect that I want to be part of the Al-Ba'ath Party and give them all the loyalty and blah, blah, blah.
That's what you're signing.
Yeah, you've write your name and then sign. So I
already filled form. You just write your name and sign.
Right,
that's
right.
It.
And I was looked at this paper. I just thought I've never thought I will not sign it. I just think I will take this paper to my parents I will have that discussion with them, as we always did. And then I can come back to the teacher and decide if I will sign it or not. And I've just, like, take the paper, stand up. I said, like, sorry, can I take it with me to tomorrow? And then I'll bring it with me tomorrow. And she was like, yeah. She was, like, shouting in front of the whole class. We were, like, more than 40 students in the class. And how rude I am, how I don't know. And she was saying, sign it and give it to me. And then I'm very headstrong. And I was like, I'm sorry, I will not sign it. I will take it with me to home and ask my parents. And then tomorrow I know. I don't know what does that mean. And she was like, get, like, crazy. And she kicked me out of the class. She gave me a lot of, like, how rude I am, how impolite. And my father was a teacher in the same school before. So they know him. He has a lot of respect in the area. So she just said, like, go home. I will speak to your father. So I will tell you how rude you are. And then I went home. When I entered home, he was speaking on the phone and he was very angry. And then he closed and he said, like, look, what happened? I've told him 1, 2, 3. And then he was like, give me the paper. I give it to him. And then he, like,
tears it up
and said, if you want to sign this, you can go back to your teacher and tell her, give me another paper and sign it. If you don't, no one can force you to do this. And I was the only student in the whole, like, class for more than, like, 6 years later, I wasn't a member. And every, like, small problem or big problem in the school, it was because of me.
Should be marked by this.
Even if I was absent, you know, if I wasn't at school at all, this is because of what did something. It's just, like, very clear.
So I will tell you what other parents might do.
Yeah.
And, like, hearing this, like, like that time, if I heard the story, like, those parents are crazy. Like, how dare them to do this? What other parents will do is to come immediately to the school, slap their son or daughter in front of everyone. Yeah. Like, you are rude, you are impolite. How dare you to say this? I will, like, give you some manners lessons at home when we're back. Sign this paper and then we'll talk later at home. And then at home they will tell him, like, we are very sorry, but we don't want to be arrested.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
I'll never put my family in this situation, by the way.
No, it's funny.
That's your style, Hamza.
Wad says a few minutes ago, she is headstrong, and I think it shows up in the first 5 minutes of the film. My parents always said I was headstrong, yeah. So we knew that. One last question about what you're talking about, which is you said how members of your family had gone away to work so you could make more money than you can make in Syria. Do most people intend to come back?
Usually they, like, for example, my family went there. They usually spend the vacation in Syria. And this is also for, like, American listeners, why you might hear some people, like, here in America, Syrians, tell you, oh, our country was so beautiful. But because they would just go there with plenty amount of money for 1 month, so they are expected. They go to the fancy restaurants. They had, like, rent a car, go drive. Of course it was beautiful, but not like the workers class, not for the people who struggle just to live in Syria in daily basis. And after that, like, for example, my family, which is most of the people I know, my uncles, my friend's father, they went to Saudi Arabia for 25 years. Both of them are math teachers. And that's how they were afford to buy a house. And then we went back when my older sister, my biggest sister, was in university. So we all come back to Syria and we lived there.
So in other words, the people who are able to leave are the ones who are the upper class or the upper middle class.
Exactly.
And if you were not able to leave, get an education, make more money, you're probably going to stay where you are.
Exactly, yeah. 100%. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and even if you study, like, this is not about going to the university because this is just one level. But whatever you graduate, if you are not in that loyalty for Al-Ba'ath Party or the, let's say, the corruption system or the even the security forces, the secret security forces, you can't get any job. Even if you are, like, the first,
in other words, even if you're the smartest, the most capable,
whatever your qualification,
if you don't have those connections,
whatever your qualification was, if someone who didn't have any like education. He is just a small like member of the army. He can like slap you in front of the old people. He can
arrest
like beat
you. He can do whatever he wants.
Even if you are a professor at the university, no one can speak with anyone. This is just a quiet of a security country. It's nothing about who are you.
We know several people like that. Even if you want to like start a project or something your own, like you don't want to go to that university course and the academic academic way, and you like we know that they will share you with your like project or your dreams or whatever, like just because you are on, like basically we're living in their farm.
So in other words, if you're an entrepreneur, they get a piece of whatever you do.
Exactly. And the more successful you are, the more harassed they will be to you, and the biggest share they will take from you.
And I'm guessing if at a certain point you go, okay, and you're welcoming, and you become, now I'll work with you, then they'll...
You'll have more business.
Then you'll have more business. Yeah. And
exactly.
Then now you've entered the club.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For people, again, what is the population of Syria?
It was in 2010 or 9, around 25 million.
And as I said, 1.5 have been killed.
Nobody knows the real numbers, because every time, like every few months, we hear another massacre, more like smuggled pictures came from the Al-Assad presence, and we just got a list of 1,000 names. Nobody knows, like...
Mm-hmm.
I think like in the future, a lot of massacres were revealed.
So you're saying if that number I quoted, which I found online of 1.5, you're saying it might be that, it might be more, because there are things which didn't come out. And then the number of people at this point who have either fled the country or been, I guess there's two different numbers, those who have fled their home and are somewhere else.
Exactly,
in Syria,
the internal displacement.
Internal displacement, exactly. And those who have left. What are those numbers like?
The refugees around the world, as Human Rights Watch, was more than 6 million.
And the internal displaced is almost the same number,
so
like 5 to 6. Yeah.
That's 12 out of 25.
Yeah. Exactly.
Unbelievable. Okay. So... let's move now towards, I had asked you, what was your life before? And then I'm going back to Wad. What is your moment when you begin to shoot as I said, the first scene I see in the movie is graffiti, you know, young students and everyone. Is this the Arab Spring or just after the Arab Spring?
Yeah, actually with the Arab Spring, when that happened and Syria was like... fortunate.
We're next.
Yeah, we are next. We are now. And this is something we've never thought that will happen. The fact just like, you know, you've seen a lot of people in the street like shouting and chanting about God, Syria and only freedom, which is the other side of, since we were very, very young, we were saying like God, Syria and only Assad.
So that statement is a twist.
This is the part of the change when we felt that we can do something, and it shouldn't be just Assad. It should be someone else. It should be Assad if people really want that. But it's more about, you know, like we need the freedom. We need the dignity. We need the feeling that this country is ours and we are citizens in this country. We belong to this place. We have that connection. We have this relationship. And this is that moment, really, in 2011, when we feel that we're proud of we are Syrians.
So what you're saying is, when you say that moment, you mean the first time
in
your
life? Yeah, first time in my... not just.
It's beginning to stir inside of you that we could be a people.
Not just we, but even our parents, even our like grandparents, when they've never think about something out of Assad family, out of this farm. And this was really the first time when we feel that we can... this farm could be really a country where we can really be proud of. I start shooting at the university, and then like gradually when Aleppo was divided to two places out of the regime control, I moved to east part of Aleppo.
And East Aleppo was the part that was under opposition control.
Yeah.
West Aleppo, still under Assad,
yeah.
Al-Assad, and the population of Aleppo.
The population of Aleppo before this divided was 6 million.
Okay. I mean,
Aleppo,
huge.
Aleppo as a city with the countryside, which is very, very a huge area. And if we want to more specific about the numbers.
That's you're talking about the district is around like 6 million, and the city was around maybe 3.5 million.
And when it divides into east and west, how
the highest population that the east, because east was the most like targeted place.
Yes,
it's considered the most dangerous city in the world in 2015. So, but the highest population by the local councils reached 1.5 million civilians. And during the siege of Aleppo, there was 300,000 people living there.
Oh, okay.
During the last like few months.
And let me go to Hamza now. So she is at the university, sees some graffiti, starts to shoot it. What's your sort of initiation?
Yeah. So I'll speak frankly. In the first days of the revolution, I never believed that those pictures we are seeing from Daraa is real. I thought that it was just like some fake propaganda to put the people against the regime. Not because there are millions of reasons to start a revolution in Syria, but I didn't believe that, like, I thought, like, how dare you? You know, like, how come? Like, how dare you to stand against the regime? Like, I didn't think that there might be a courage in ourselves.
So it wasn't that you were offended, how dare you? It was, how did you come up with the courage?
Exactly.
Who could possibly think they could?
Exactly. Like, it's just not possible. So basically the first, like, three weeks, I was just watching the news between several, like, non-Syrian challenge, not local challenge, and the local challenge, just to compare what's going on here, And both, like, the let's say the opposition channels were saying that the Syrian regime were shooting people and killing them, and al-Assad regime was saying that no, there are like terrorist group and gangs are shooting on people to make this like conflict start. And then al-Assad start his first speech in like the house of the parliament, if we like parliament, but like, yeah, the house of his own people.
Al-Assad's so, parliament.
Exactly. And it was, he was just laughing that everything is fine, everything is okay. He never mentioned anything about the people who were killed. He didn't say any word about them. And that's why, like this man should be down. Like, that's it. And this is when I just
for
decided.
For you personally.
Exactly. I decided just to, whatever it takes, I will keep like doing what's right for ourselves, for our generation, for the people, and just start demonstrating at the university everywhere, trying to start like small groups for like medical groups to help the injured protesters. And then when East Aleppo was announced like a non-government control area, that was on the 21st of July 2012, I decided to move to the east part of Aleppo and just stay there.
And you were in a relationship at this point?
Yeah.
And she moves with you?
No, unfortunately.
Ah.
Oh, so no, I can't say this. Unfortunately, I'm married now. And this is what start like the whole story about being divided that time. And
so, I mean, this is what was happening to you, where you choose the uprising and she wasn't your wife at the time, or she was?
In 2012, we weren't married, but then we got married.
Ah.
And she like moved to Turkey, and I was going back and forth from Turkey to Aleppo, and there was like a difficult
choice, and you chose the uprising.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm guessing you weren't the only one, the only couple to be going through that sort of thing. I mean, that this must have split families.
Exactly. Very, yeah. There are so
very common, like
yeah, so many, a lot of people were just having this, let's say, struggle at that time, because there were so many, like, you can't just take your easily for anyone to take his family and start a family in
East Aleppo.
In East Aleppo, it was easy for the people who are from there, because it's their home. But like for myself, the first time I ever went to East Aleppo, and that was also part of the corruption that we were living. I've never in my life went to East Aleppo. And I'm from Aleppo. I don't know how those people were living, what's their circumstances. And Western Aleppo, I think it's just like any West city, you feel like more richer and than the East. Like it's just Berlin, I think New York, the same,
right,
London.
As we say, the other side of the tracks, you know.
So for me, I like grew up in the West side of the city because my parents were out of the country. So that's they were right. afford to buy a good house and stay there. And I've never in my life went to east part of Aleppo. I had no idea where people are living. And that's when I were like several people from my friends were saying like we were living a good life. I told them like, no, you were living a good life. Look at the other people. They were like living in just like random places, built with like the minimum conditions. Yeah, right. It was just like unbearable for them.
We all, like people who lived through this experience in east part of Aleppo, we have that connection now with the east part more than the west. All of us, all our memories now, if we want to really now, if we can have the chance to be back, all of us, we will back to east part of Aleppo. And this is what the revolution did. It's just like it's removed all the walls between people. It's removed all the differences between the areas, the people. And it just you feel that you are connect with Syria. Syria as just one country. We are all together in this. We are all just sharing everything together.
Yeah, we lived the dream in East Aleppo. Before 2011, our generation, our dream was to just leave Syria. And after 2011, our dream just to stay in Syria.
Yeah, which and of course, as I already said, the end of the film is when you accept exile as a condition of being able to live.
Exactly, right. The only way to.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my recent conversation with Fouad Al-Khatib and Edward Watts, directors of the award-winning documentary For Sama, and with Dr. Hamza Al-Khatib, who ran the last hospital in East Aleppo, Syria. For Sama airs on PBS Tuesday, November 19th, and I couldn't recommend it more highly.
So you begin shooting, you've moved to East Aleppo, and you are, you're just working as a doctor?
Exactly. I just graduated from the medical college. And start working there with like several other doctors.
So when do you begin to set up a hospital?
At the end of 2012, the people start to come back to East Aleppo because the first, the announcement, and we know that the regime will start like to launch the tanks, several mortar attacks. So just people fled out of the area. And after like 3 months, the situation become not too subtle, but people want to settle down. It's their houses, their neighborhoods. There is no place else to go. The government wasn't like supported any like, and this is a lot of things that when I do some interviews or spoke with any Western people, they were usually ask me like, so the governments were providing this place with the camps. Like, no, they're trying to kill them. And like sometimes they ask me like, and when we were working at the hospital, so the government were paying for you because like it's their responsibility, even if it's a conflict area, is to keep the healthcare system working. And like, no, actually they target us 3 times with aircraft.
Well, so. There's one of the things that comes up is that you learn that the strategy that it is safer, there's a joke, right, that it is safer to be on the front lines than to be in a hospital in East Aleppo.
Exactly. The Syrian regime strategy was to make it impossible for the people to live there. That's the main thing, that there is no way you can be in
out of
my farm, but out of my control. There is no like no way to have this. So the only way to do it was to attacking like, or targeting the bakeries, the schools, and the hospitals. So like it was just to break the people's will to do anything.
And let me just say, the film opens, the first 4 or 5 minutes, we are in the hospital you were in at the end. And let me just say, the film jumps back and forth in time. So at that point, at the opening, we're in
Al-Quds Hospital in east part of Aleppo.
What year is
2016.
That?
2016.
So that's 2016. And we have this nice scene. And I think Wad's talking about her daughter, Sama, and so on. And we hear the shelling outside the doors. And so within a few minutes, we are racing down corridors. And what I want to say for people, I recommend the film. Absolutely. Graphic. I mean, you will see lots of blood, but what I felt within 5 minutes, I said to myself, I have no problems. Do you know what I mean? In other words, I saw what you folks were living And I said, I got no complaints.
Yeah, because it's real. It's life. It's people really living this every day, not just in the film 3 years ago, but even now, today. When I woke up today, 6:30 in the morning, U.S. time, I've seen like a big market in Idlib countryside was targeted. Like now you've seen, there's a picture of a father like trying to rescue his daughter, and his daughter, which is, you can't see what age is she, but you can see her like her hands getting out of the rebels, and she's also carrying a baby. Like it's unbelievable.
And that's
today as we're speaking today. And I don't know how many people were killed today, but also like 2 days ago, another market in another city next to Idlib also, it was targeted and more than 54 people were killed.
And those cities are around maybe 30 to 40 kilometers far away from the front lines. So that's why it's safer to live in the front lines. Because the regime will just target the markets. It will target the bakeries, the schools, the hospitals, to break the will of the people.
Civilians are the target. It's not a mistake. Let me just read a little bit from the UK Guardian recently. April 26th, at least 544 civilians have been killed, over 2,000 people injured since a Russian-led assault on the last rebel bastion in northwestern Syria began 2 months ago. So that's April, that's March and April. The two-month-old campaign has left dozens of villages and towns in ruins. According to the United Nations, at least 300,000 people forced to leave their homes. An aerial strike, this would have been in the very start of July, that made a hospital in Kafrnabal. The 30th hospital to be bombed during this campaign. Your hospitals, that isn't even counting. This was 30 in this campaign. So just so people get the sense, because I believe that one thing that your movie will do, at least for the people who talk about it, the people who hear this, the people who see it, will remember, Syria. I thought that was over.
Yeah.
Exactly. We're like, ISIS is over, then we're fine. Like, Syria is a safe place. And that's what, like, the statistics shows clearly that maybe, like, I will not say no, because it's, like, aesthetically it's wrong to say, like, no one. But I think no one from all those 6 million refugees in the world came back to Syria after ISIS. Because they hadn't fled because of ISIS.
It was saying they didn't flee because of ISIS.
Exactly. It was just because their will was broken by the Syrian regime, that it's impossible to live there, and that's why they fled.
The main things of the main message, let's say, of the film, is this story is ended with us that we were lucky, but other people not. And what you've seen in the film is a real life. These 4 minutes at the beginning, opening side of the film, which you felt, you said it's very like hard to watch, but same time, this is real. This is people living this. As we're speaking now, there's people living the same situation right now. And it's really like, we're trying now to give people this opportunity to go through my life and live this 1.5 hours in a place, in a hospital in Syria, which is home for us. It's not something strange for us. We lived this. We were sleeping and woke up in that place. And people right now in last area out of the regime control, they have the same circumstances. It's hard, but it's very important to watch. The solution of that, not to close our eyes and said that this is so far and this is very difficult. This is real. This is people living this. It could be you. It could be your daughter. It could be your, like, children. And we should open our minds and our hearts for others, for this pain, for this suffering, and really try to make difference.
I wanted to add just a small thing for your listeners here, just what these guys are saying. I think so often people in the West, you know, we look at these conflicts in the Middle East and it just seems like there's no right, there's no wrong, everyone's as bad as each other, it's all a big mess. But Syria is different because of what these guys are saying. You know, there is a case whereby you have these innocent people basically are standing against the overwhelming military force of a fascistic dictatorship, and they are slaughtering civilians just for asking for basic rights that people here in America, in my country, in the UK, take for granted. You know, I hesitate to say it, but in this situation, there are like goodies and baddies, basically, you know, which it seems like very simplistic, but actually, you know, you can say very clearly who are the ones who are killing children today, you know,
That's right. That is the dictatorship of the Assad regime, the Russian.
Yeah.
Just choose the side that isn't killing children.
You side the with killing children, or the side that thinks killing children is the worst thing that can happen. Right. You know.
Let me just say to people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with filmmakers Wad Al-Khatib and Edward Watts. That was Edward we just heard. And also in the studio with us is Dr. Hamza Al-Khatib, a key figure in the documentary film For Sama. I do want to get to a little bit of a conversation between Edward and Wad about how you made the film. But the first thing I'm going to do is quickly describe what I feel the film is. And then each of you, you know, add what I missed. And then let's talk about the making of it, which is that in 93 minutes, we spend, as you were saying there, Wad, we spend time with you in your life. And what you do in the film is you go light, dark, right? We see sirens go off. We see people come in bleeding. We see people die in front of us, lose people in the hospital. We are, and one thing that you do very effectively, I think, is we are constantly, we're watching the film. I think, get the feeling we're safe, and now comes another bomb, another tank, that sort of thing. So that, and then you go to the quiet sections. You know, you wake up in the morning, you have flowers in your garden, you have wonderful scenes with Sama. What I do want you to talk about just now is what you felt when you realized you were pregnant in that situation, and how you dedicate the film to Sama.
We decided to have a child in this place.
So Hamza and Wad meet, you know, as compatriots, and they fall in love and they get married. And one thing I love is we see your wedding, which is one of those light moments of light, and we see you dancing to Crazy for Loving You.
Yeah.
Is that actually what's playing?
Yeah, exactly. You've seen that in the film.
So you decided to have a child.
Yeah, we were, suddenly you feel that you are stuck in this place and you stay for forever and you don't want to leave. It's not just a choice, but it's something. You love this place. You are amazed with this place. You are feeling with these people as your family. When we were there, like no one of, not my parents, not his parents, no one who we knew before.
It just Came to East Aleppo. Everyone
just was there. We just knew them now. And you feel that they are your families more than really your sisters and the brothers. And you just feel that this is the life that I want to live. And this is the life where I want to really die for. We decided just to start our small family in this place. We wanted to belong more to the place. And then we decided, yeah, we will have a child as others in the city. And this is what just kind of the defend the fears, defend...
Well, defiance, in a way, right? In other words, he's saying, I will make it so you can't even live there. And you say, no, we're going to bring life here.
Yeah, exactly. We will live. We will live.
Like, strengthen our roots in this place.
Yeah.
And we had that idea and we will make it. Like, and I was pregnant and I was just, as much as I have a lot of fears and I can't ignore that. But at the same time, I was, like, very happy. It was the most beautiful, like, day in all my life.
When you found out?
Yeah, I'm pregnant now. I have life while all the death around me. He's trying to killing us, but we will bring this life. And it was just, like, kind of the, like, it stayed until now. We still feel that feeling, you know, how strong we are. And just something give you a lot of hope.
Yes.
The hope that we were just looking for.
Now, at times in the film, you do speak to Sama and you say, will you ever forgive me?
Yeah.
How could I have done this to you? So obviously you go back and forth.
Of course, yeah. And even that minutes when you feel that, okay, I'm pregnant now and we have also a big responsibility. We should find a way how we will protect her, how we will be like giving her as much life as we can. And like, that's one of the things why I follow Salem and Afra family, because I felt this has given me a lot of hope. This give me a sense about how I will deal with my daughter when she will be alive.
And you dedicate the film to her. And basically what you're saying is so that she and others can see the life.
Exactly. And they have a chance to understand what was happening, why we decided to bring them to this life, what this life looked like, and how we were very like hope that one day it will be not as we live right now at that moment. Later on, like let's say after 5 years of shooting that film in Syria, and then when I moved out, when we forced to flee out, and then I was in Turkey and then London, when I met with Edward, and we decided to start doing the film. And when I shoot everything, it was kind of the shooting, some of the personal stuff, as you've seen, and some of the other stories outside as a normal journalist. And I... Through filming that, I was speaking with Sama in some places, as any other mom around the world will do.
Yeah, there are scenes interspersed in the film where you are speaking to your child.
Yeah,
and let me bring Edward in now. How did you meet Wad? How did the film happen?
Well, we always wish there was a really great anecdote to tell here, but actually it was essentially we were match made, because it was only after Wad was and Hamza were forced to flee that everyone realized that she had this incredible archive. Some of her stuff had been on the news and she'd won an Emmy for it, we should say. And she'd done very well with her news reports, but no one realized that she had this complete, like, incredible hinterland of all the personal stuff that you're talking about. So when people saw this, like... a heap of war-battered hard drives full of all these clips and all of this life, over 500 hours or so, they were like, who can support her, basically, to tell her own story? And they thought I'd be appropriate because I was passionate about Syria, passionate about it for the reasons I mentioned earlier. And I've done a lot of documentaries before, so it felt like we might be a good little team. Plus, I'm up for a robust argument, which was an essential characteristic of anyone who would work with Wad, because we had very headstrong, and we had a very robust and honest and direct collaboration, basically. And I think it's us coming together. It's our two minds bashing and collaborating and talking and forging stuff together that makes the film as strong as it is.
That makes sense to me.
It's a Syrian and a Western point of view.
Boom!
Infusing, yeah.
Right. And but not like just some little lovely meld.
Oh my God, I wish, please.
No, I don't wish that. I'm very proud of how fighting we had through the process, because what we have now is just because we were both very passionate about the film. We want it to be as perfect as we can. And
from an outsider point of view, because I was just hearing all those like arguments on the phone, and like Wad came back angry to the house, and then it's like I got to go to speak with Edward now. So many like things. Now like, Edward like talking to me from back the scenes, like, please can you tell Wad to calm down. Please. And the thing is, Wad was always want to tell the story that she wanted to make, to tell the Syrian story.
She the didn't journalist.
Want to make, exactly. She didn't want to make it like, I don't, like she clearly said that I don't want to just shortcut Aleppo's story, just become me. I don't want to be that person, just like it's all around me and I'm like the woman in Aleppo, etc. But the main of the conversations was between like Ed saying like, but people will not be very interested in just that, like Syria, the news stuff. It will not be that.
I was trying to find a way, because we knew in this whole process, as you said, you know, Syria's, the conflict's gone on for a long time and there have been films about it. And a bit like you said, I think earlier, you know, people think it's over.
Yeah,
and, you know,
do.
What happened? And actually, this is so different. And what these guys lived through, who they are, but also what Wad managed to capture on camera, is so different from anything anyone's seen about Syria that, you know, I was just, my concern was to do justice to their incredible achievement, but from a cinematic sense, but also just from a life sense in what they'd done in their lives, because I felt that this story and this footage had the power to touch people, even on the streets of LA or San Francisco or Nantucket or Sheffield, which is just a number of the places we've been.
No, that makes very good sense. So the let me ask about a couple of decisions. The decision to go back and forth in time. How did you come up with that?
We started first with very chronologically way.
Sure.
And we needed that actually, because like Edward was, he've never been to Syria in that situation. Mm. So he needs time to understand the footage and how we went through and what like Syria's story is very complicated. My story also very complicated. So we really needed time to understand everything. Yeah, and he actually now lived this 5 years through
the Middle East. I
bet.
And for me, I was just left Syria like 3 months ago, and I was very emotional with the situation. We've just feel that we lost everything. It was very hard for me even to stand and like be very strong about the story and judge a lot of things. So we started that chronologically so we can have the main line that we want to work on and decided what material. And because also the archive was very, very huge.
Huge.
Yeah, so we started at that point and we just want to build the main contact that we want to work on.
So even as you're doing the chronological, you know you might go away from it, but you need it as a foundation.
Yeah, of course we will go away, but we don't know what the main key of that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We were just literally trying to map the landscape at that point. Because, I mean, part of the job, which took months, was just literally getting a handle on this
500 hours.
Huge archive. You know, we sat for hours, days, you know, 16-hour days where WAD would be playing a bit of footage, explaining all the hinterland behind each clip and how they interrelated. So, yeah.
And the film could be really three different films now. If we decided to change the plan. We have plan A, plan B, plan C in every scene. And not just the same stories, but even different stories.
Sure. No, I'm thinking there are whole families probably that you shot, and we would have, were the movie differently, we would see them beginning and people would die and we'd watch it. And that's on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. Even the light scenes of like the wedding, there we have a lot of nice things where it could be like really main part of the story. But then when we decided to be like through the, let's say, the main personal way, through that we can speak about the city and the other massacres happen, the other big general events. And then we felt at the end of this that it was very like light at the beginning and then very dark at the end. Dark to the point that people can't, they will start like engaged with the film, but they will have the way that I don't want to see what the bad ending of this
story. Let me just make sure that it's clear what you're saying, that there were always parts of light and dark, but in one particular cut or one take on it, all the light seemed to go away, and it ended with, what, 20, 30 minutes of dark.
That's exactly the chronological way, because that was the truth in the sense that you see it started with all the hope of the initial revolution, and then you end with the siege, and that was it. And that's why we had to break out of that, really, because that didn't reflect the truth as well of, like, the human experience.
That even in those dark times, there were moments
exactly.
of light. Otherwise, you'd have killed yourself.
Exactly. And this is what we...
Such a pleasure to meet someone who gets it, like, very clearly.
Exactly. When we were speaking about, like, if I want to tell the story to anyone, I will start, of course, with the first beginning of the story. But I will just go, like, first and back with this, because this is what the brain... A human being telling any story around the world, you relate it to something. When I will speak about when I was, about Sama in the siege, I will be back when the moment when she was born. And all these things, it's just things give us strength during the last 6 months of the darkness, let's say, of the life in the siege in Aleppo.
And given that we're in LA as well, you know, I think, and we're talking to no doubt lots of... screenwriters and all of that, people who make movies. I think another thing that helped us with all of that was thinking about it in terms of almost like a narrative structure, in terms of five acts, because actually you began to see that the material kind of, you know, there was an initial point, which was about pure hope and sort of the love of these guys. Then there was about pregnancy, you know, then there was about just the initial moment of Sama arriving, but also the decision to go back into the city. So kind of underneath the dock, there is, in a very light touch, there is a kind of classical story structure, which also then helped to inform the way that the flashbacks and the light and dark played out.
Well, you say five. What were the other two?
Well, then, of course, you have catastrophe, basically, which is act four. And then you have a sort of form of catharsis, a little bit resolution at the end.
You mean just the leaving?
The leaving, but also I think, you know...
The leaving, which is a very key point for us.
Disaster, but also the memories, you know. I think the point is that the film, and this was something that came through so much from being with these guys and our discussions, that despite all of that horror in the film, you know, as you heard today, these guys loved Aleppo, and that was the... emotion that I was always getting from them, that they'd look back on this time, which to us as outsiders would be like, God, it must have been a nightmare. But I feel like there was so much joy, and that was yeah, what we had to end on, basically.
And the last thing about the hope that we still alive, live for right now, it's after everything happened, we want to continue. There's nothing will stop us to tell like the truth of the story and shift the narrative about Syria and try it really to make difference in people's life as Syrians. And this is still like why everything is really worth. Mm-hmm. Because we're doing that for our children, for our future, for the new generation.
What is it you want people to get from the film? And where can people learn more? And what can people do?
The first and the big main thing for how everything we've went through, to speak about the truth of anything happening. Syria as conflict is not a civil war. It's a revolution, and it started like this, and it's still continuing like this. The main things about everything was happened just to make a new future for us, for our children, for the new face of Syria. And this is what we went through, and this is why we sacrificed everything from the beginning until right now as we're speaking. What's going on now, it should be a red line. It should be something people can't accept. In this, in 2019, it should be like stop, like bombing hospitals. It should be something no one can agree with. But unfortunately, what you've seen, even in the security for like Security Council, in the UN, in all these like things which we shift our life as a human being, not just right now, but also for the next 100 years, it all should be something not allowed to happen anymore. And this is what we are trying to do in our impact campaign after the film. It's more about stop bombing hospitals and make it something, not just red line, but it's accountability. It's something bring justice to the people we lost, to the people who are still alive until now and having this experience every day.
And just to add, like, please follow, like, to everyone who's listening, you know, the Impact Campaign is being set up, as Wad says. Like, we have a website, For Sama Film, you know.
Okay, let me just say that again. ForSamaFilm.com. Those three words together, F-O-R.
F-O-R-S-A-M-A,
Sama, For Sama Film.
Film, you got it. And that's the same on Facebook and the same on Twitter and Instagram and everything as well.
For Sama Film on all those social media accounts.
Please follow us. You know, we've got a lot of plans about how we're going to turn the popular reaction to achieve some of the things Wad's talking about.
Because this film is not just a film, it's a life. It's people like experienced this before and still having the same experience. It's a chance to everyone to try to live in Aleppo or in any place in Syria for an hour and a half. Yeah.
Hamza.
I think the film is... when they were trying to do the film, I thought just about will be a film about Syria or Aleppo and that's it. But I think the film like highlights so many issues all around the world. The refugees crisis, those refugees are not happened to become refugees. They had stories. They have roots to their countries. I'm a refugee now in the UK, and I've like, just like when I was a teenager, I didn't dream to become a refugee in the UK. It's not part of my dream. And just like because we had like a natural disaster and then became refugees, there are people that did this to us, that killed our friends, that destroyed our infrastructure, destroyed our country.
Plan and strategy, and they're still doing that.
And maybe we're not back to Syria in the next future. Maybe it's still happening in Idlib, but in the upcoming years, justice should happen to those victims.
Very good. We got to bring it to a close. Again, the film is For Sama. It opens in New York and L.A. the weekend of July, this weekend, July 26th.
Friday 26th.
And then there will be a national rollout following that. The website, as you said, forsamafilm.com or the various social media sites, Instagram, Facebook, etc. You can Twitter, For Sama Film. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. So that is all those words together, aworldthatjustmightwork.com or terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net. If you want to get a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the context, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, M-A-C.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or many of the other podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts there. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you. Waad Al-Khatib.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Hamza Al-Khatib.
Thank you.
And Edward Watts.
Thank you very much.
Keep up your good work.
Thank you.